You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Doug Paul. I'm from the Carnegie Endowment and here to welcome our very distinguished guest on a return visit to Carnegie. It's my great pleasure to introduce the Minister of Finance of Government of France, Christine Lagarde. Fortune magazine has called her an intelligent, straight-talking leader with silky, smooth diplomatic skills. The Economist, to her credit, praises her for having the disarming tendency of saying what she thinks. And for finance ministers, that's unusually disarming. She's above all a great friend and person of extraordinary accomplishment, and we're so pleased to have her here. Before going into government, Madame Lagarde was the first woman to chair the powerhouse international law firm of Baker & McKenzie. Many of you know that she's also spent a lot of time in Chicago. And these days in Washington, we have a hard time telling who's not from Chicago. She was lured back to Paris in 2005 to become Minister of Trade, and she took responsibility for WTO negotiations and promoting French exports. And just 2 years later, with a great eye for talent, President Sarkozy appointed her Minister for Economy, Industry, and Employment, making her the first woman ever to serve as finance minister of a G8 country. A recipient of the Légion d'honneur, France's highest honor, she's today responsible for guiding the French economy through the greatest downturn since the Great Depression. The reason she's here with us tonight is that her already considerable job portfolio is going to be made a little bigger. In November, France is poised to assume the 12-month rotating presidency of the G20. In recent years, under the leadership of the UK and now South Korea, the G20 has helped coordinate expansionary macroeconomic policies, promoted stronger financial regulation, and significantly expanded the resources and capabilities, and I should say representation inside the IMF. As France assumes leadership of the G20, it does so at a time of still significant economic turmoil. The IMF has reduced growth forecasts for the coming year, and the pace of hoped-for recovery remains sluggish, particularly in the advanced economies. During the coming months, the G20 will grapple with a daunting array of challenges, from unemployment to private sector growth to reining in government deficits and rebalancing global trade. Madame Lagarde joins us here tonight to discuss her country's priorities for the year ahead and the agenda it intends to lay out for the world's economic leaders. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Christine Lagarde.
Thank you very, very much for the introduction. And thank you for reminding me of lovely years in good old Chicago. What you missed out, actually, is a year I spent in Washington, D.C.
People from Washington don't seem to get jobs in the new administration.
But I was here at a memorable time, actually, back in 73, 74. And I worked on the Hill, surprisingly, at the time. So that's where I learned, really, what politics was all about. And I have great memories. Now, you asked me to talk about my agenda, the G20 agenda, what we are trying to improve going forward. And I'm delighted to have been invited by your organization. I see really Carnegie as a bridge between Europe and the United States, and I think it's a tribute to the real founder, Carnegie, this British citizen that was eventually made an American citizen at the end of the day, and who was himself a bridge between, I wouldn't say two continents, because my British colleagues would probably argue that they're not part of the continent, and rightly so, actually, if I judge from the discussions that we have within European Union, where sometimes they tend to say, we in Great Britain, you in Europe. And we have to remind them now and again that the UK is actually part and parcel of the European Union. But anyway, Carnegie was this great bridge, and I think it's excellent that you have institutions of that caliber and nature to actually make sure that people talk the truth and are prepared to debate and to confront ideas and propose new concepts. Now, turning to... I've decided not to talk about currencies. That's a letdown, I know. But I was asked to actually talk about the G20 agenda. And I'm sure you'll have a few questions here and there which are ancillary to the G20. Going back to where it all started, G20 was just a gathering of ministers of finance, governors of central banks. The whole thing was created on the steps of the Asian crisis. And we had our gatherings and we had our brainstorming together, but it was not much more than that. Until eventually President George W. Bush, convinced, I would argue, by President Sarkozy and a few others, including José Manuel Barroso, agreed with the fact that it was necessary to have a smaller group of people at the highest level to actually deal with the crisis when it hit all of us. And that G20 at the time, whether it was in Washington, then in London, then in Pittsburgh, then to a lesser degree in Toronto, that G20 really was able to cope with the crisis at the time and was able to react, to be very proactive, to collect views and thoughts. And it was really the first time that a group of leaders representing 85% of world GDP could actually address all the issues that were facing us. And I would list as, I would say, probably the three key achievements at the time of the G20 as, number one, rescuing, really, the financial system that was about to go down the tube. Remember the liquidity crisis and the way in which all of them, together with their central bankers, decided to tackle the issue head on and to effectively rescue the system and inject masses of capital into it. That was the first achievement. The second achievement is that they decided together to address the issue of growth. It wasn't lagging growth. It was not that fragile growth that is commented upon. It was negative growth, and negative in a big way, together with unemployment. And they decided to address that particular problem, especially at the London meeting, with the decision to actually set up this framework for growth, which was really targeted at making sure that the right policies were decided in as collective a way as possible, in as concerted a fashion as possible, to make sure that we had this sustainable, solid and balanced growth that everybody was looking for at the time. So that was the second achievement. And I would put as a third achievement at the time the fact that the G20 managed to avoid the worst that could have happened, which would have been protectionism. Clearly, if countries had retracted, had decided that closing boundaries and raising tariffs was actually the way to go, we would have had something a lot worse than what we've seen up until now. So that was, at a time of crisis, the key achievements of the G20. Added to that, of course, you have the tripling of resources of the IMF, the reinforcement of the institution, the role that was attributed to the Financial Stability Board that was enlarged to include particularly emerging countries that were hardly represented at that level. And you should also add the chapter that had to do with development and the masses of financing that was put together to support development in the least developed countries in particular. So that's the... here goes my speech. That's the masses of achievements then. So when we look at what we could do when we take the baton from our Korean friends on the 12th of November, we have to take stock of what the achievements have been so far. And we clearly have to also take stock of what the South Korean presidency will have achieved. And they're clearly moving in various directions that will bear fruit, I'm sure about that. One which clearly will be a starting point from us in one particular chapter that I will come to in a minute is the financial safety nets and the clear objective to set up, including at a regional level, ways for countries to actually be able to respond to liquidity crisis, be able to respond to the type of financial crisis that could hit and that did hit. Second is certainly, and I'll come to that as well in my sort of fourth chapter, that's already a clue, there will be actually four chapters that we want to embark upon in this French presidency, is this road for development. I think there is a particular acronym for it, but it's essentially a multi-year program that is intended to support the development of the least developed developed countries, be it with or without a completed Doha round. And no doubt we will see communique after communique, as you are all used to it, if you're familiar with the round that everybody is very keen to complete, but it simply doesn't happen. So turning now to what as French presidency, we want to achieve. Nicolas Sarkozy has actually indicated late in the summer what the main directions would be. And drawing on what I identified as one of the jobs that South Korea wants to complete is, remember, the financial safety nets. And that takes us to chapter number one that we want to try to open, which has to do with the international monetary system. Ha, here comes the currencies, you think. No, no, no. It'd be tempting, though. Why should we deal with the international monetary system? Well, simply because, as it stands at the moment, it doesn't seem to be particularly effective. If you look at the variation of currencies that have taken place, particularly in the last 10 years, and more recently so, if you look at the masses of liquidity that move around without much control in some cases, if you look at the capital flows in and out of developing countries in particular, clearly there is an issue. And if you look additionally at the latest moves, I should say, that have taken place, whether from Brazil or from Japan, for instance, let alone from China, you really wonder what kind of coordination there is. So our purpose with this thinking process that we want to kickstart, without drawing conclusion from the start and without being quite certain that we will end up somewhere before the end of the year, because it takes time actually to get people to agree on such thing as the international monetary system. But clearly we want to tackle three essential proposals. One is we want to try to explore ways to protect particularly those least developed countries and sometimes emerging countries from which there have been capital flows, as I said, in and out, depending on expectations and currency variations. So protecting will be one avenue to explore. The second one will be diversify, because as it stands today, there is clearly a lack of diversification, which induces in and of itself a level of risk that is associated with the currency variation. And third, there is really a need to actually coordinate and coordinate better, because decisions that are made unilaterally are not going to be as efficient as if they were made, as it happened in the past, on a much more concerted basis. So that's my little chapter on the international monetary system, with these three avenues that we want to explore. And once again, it's not with a view to drawing conclusions. It's not with preconceived ideas that we should, you know, set aside this, propose that, move to the bank or new currency, or set out this SDR in a big way. There are lots of alternatives, and I'm sure that there will be plenty of academics to help us in the process. There will be ex-central bankers, current central bankers, to-be central bankers that will have their view about it. And clearly, that's what we have to do. We have to bring people together with as little preconceived ideas as possible, but with the openness to actually create something that is working better than what we have at the moment. So that's my chapter number one. Chapter number two, that has been identified by President Sarkozy as well, has to do with a mix of commodity prices and commodity market organization, coupled with the massive financialization, if that's a word that you can accept, but which has to do with the volume of derivative products and other financial instruments that are being built on the top of raw materials. And when we say raw materials, Clearly, we have in mind all sorts of things, but in particular, because France is France is France, just as like a rose is a rose is a rose, but we are particularly concerned about agricultural materials, agricultural products. And there is a clear link between that particular topic. If you look, for instance, at the evolution of the price of wheat or the evolution of the price of corn just recently as a result of the massive fires that took place in Russia. I was in Russia, I came back yesterday, and my colleague actually mentioned that the crop of wheat alone will be down by 25%, just as a result of the sort of bush and forest fires that took place over the summer. That is going to have an immediate impact on the price of wheat. If you look at the dryness that has taken place in Ukraine, we're going to have difficulties there as well. And it's clearly something that is going to stay with us. It's not just a factor of the fire or a factor of the drought. It's going to be with us simply because of the volume of farming land that there is around the world and the population that is growing around the world as it does. So it's an issue of the price setting, market mechanism, visibility and understanding of how market mechanisms actually work in those materials, in those commodities, and a matter of how the derivatives and the financial instruments associated with the actual tangible markets, with a multiple of, 30 to 34, depending on the type of commodities we're talking about, is actually organized, is actually understood, and can actually be supervised and regulated in the way we've begun to actually regulate a bit better the standard financial instruments and derivative products. So that's chapter number two. And in that process, I would certainly hope that organizations such as the World Bank, for instance, could help us in their research because they have conducted academic research on the topic. I know as well that the European Commission would be prepared also to provide help and support and thinking into that process. That's chapter number two or channel number two, however you want to call it. The third one, which is also critical, is how are we organized? What kind of governance do we have? And clearly, if you relate that to what I was saying earlier about how the G20 was effective in times of crisis, you can actually relate the two. How are we organized? A group of G20 in times of crisis actually worked. How do we keep the momentum? How do we keep up? Is a question that needs to be asked and a question that needs answer as well. Because it's all very well representing 85% of world GDP, but if you leave out of the process and the equation so many countries that represent probably those 15% of GDP, but clearly want to have a say, want to be at the table, then you have an issue that needs responses. It's a dilemma, if I may say, because one of the reasons, in my view, for having lived with it, one of the reasons the G20 was so efficient has to do with the size, has to do with the level at which it is organized, and has to do with the process by which decisions were addressed, prepared, and communicated. There was probably a bit too much by way of communique, but so be it. And clearly, we don't want to lose that. If we want to keep the momentum, we need to keep the efficiency. And yet, we need to improve the representativeness of the organization. So it's a two-edged chapter, if you want, as far as the G20 representativeness and efficiency is concerned. It's not it, because together with this issue of governance and appropriate representativeness and efficiency of the G20, we also need to think about all the other stars that are aligned or disaligned around the G20. And here, clearly, I have in mind the WTO, the International Labour Association, the IMF, the Financial Stability Board, the OECD, which all have different constituencies, and for some of them have a completely different institutional background and roots. If you look at the WTO, for instance, it has a sovereignty of its own in a way, and it has the ability to actually pass judgment, settle disputes, make it effective, and make sure that they are enforced. If you look at other organizations, they're probably closer to a la UN organizations, and how you actually organize to align the stars and to make sure that there is at least a minimum of consistency and a minimum of coordination between them and the G20 center is something that diplomats can talk about forever without ever agreeing, and where I would hope that we help in the process trying to streamline and better organize the coherence of this organization. And I'm not suggesting that we will close the chapter, but in all of those three chapters, you find a relevant section that has to do with the developing world. If you look at the international monetary system, there's the whole issue of fragility of least developed and some of the least emerged countries which suffer from the inflow and outflow of capital, the uncertainty about currencies. If you look at the second chapter, which has to do with commodity prices, here again, critical for developing countries. The volatility of raw materials affects them much more so than it affects developed countries. And if you turn to the third chapter about global governance, here again, we have an issue about the appropriate level of representation for the least developed countries. And that takes me to the fourth and last chapter, which has to do precisely with development. We will pick up the baton from where it is and where our Korean friends will leave it with this multi-year program for development. Because clearly, we need to have not just a crisis program, which was the case in 2009, but we need to have a long-term program that is not only based on these financial instruments that have been significantly improved by the IMF with the flexible credit line, for instance, but we need to have credit lines, we need to have lending terms and conditions that are actually conducive to development. And there is the whole issue of best practices as far as supporting the development of those countries that need it most. So that will be the fourth chapter, and one that will require everybody's support. As you know, there are attempts here and there to shortcut the multilateral systems that are in place to support development. Are they appropriately run? Are they with some degree of conditionalities? Sometimes is questionable. And it's that chapter that needs to be addressed as well. So, Monsieur le Président, I think I've covered my four chapters, and I would just like to take 1 minute, because I'm sure that in the group you have people that might be interested with the French economy. And you mentioned that we are at a very interesting point in time. I'd like to just say that while we did suffer in 2009, and while our economy went down by 2.6%, which was relatively mild compared with the average negative growth in the Eurozone, or the average negative growth in Germany, for instance, which went down by 4.9, we are back up, and have been back up for four quarters now. The second quarter of 2010 was extremely encouraging, and really leads us to believe that we've turned the corner, because the economy grew at a pace of 0.7%, which is really an uptick from the first quarter. And our growth forecast for the whole of 2010 was revised upward, in line actually with the IMF forecast, which is 1.6. For 2010. My forecast for 2011 is a little bit higher than that of the IMF. It's 2%. And I do believe that if we couple the three engines that have actually started, all of them, both the domestic consumption, which never went down for any quarter, including during crisis time. And that tells you a lot about the shock absorbers that the French economy had. And obviously the excellent economic policy that was put in place. The second engine that also, thank goodness, has now started is the private investment. We had clearly investment was down, but was obviously thanks to public deficits that were amplified during the end of 2008 and beginning of 2009, we had public investment to carry the burden. Now, the private investors are back, and we had private investors contribute up to 1.1% to the growth during the second quarter. And exports are also back a little bit, not to a great extent, but they are back as well. They are positive. It's a positive contribution to growth again, whereas it had been negative for at least six quarters in a row. So I do believe that we've turned the corner. Unemployment has begun to go down as well. Unemployment in France, for those of you who are not familiar with the with our charts, is generally around, at best times, it's around 7%. At worst times, it hits 10%. There is a very solid system of recording people. You hardly have anybody left out of the system. So the rate of unemployment is actually very representative of the effective unemployment in the country. I know it's not always the case in all places, because some people drop out of the system because they stop being indemnified and they stop receiving welfare. It's not exactly the same in our French system. Not that we indemnify forever, but it's what I call the one of our good shock absorbers in hard times. So unemployment, which went up to 9.6% at the highest of the crisis, has gone down to 9.5, 9.3, and we expect a 9.2 shortly. So it's on the declining path at a slowly but steady pace. And the public deficit that is really one of our key targets, together with supporting investments in the private sector, particularly from next year onwards, our public deficit, which was scheduled to be at 8.2%, sorry, we began the forecast with 8.5, then we revised downward to 8.2, and it's likely to close at 7.7. We keep our target of 6% next year to arrive at 3% in 2013. So that's pretty much where we are. I don't want to bore you with too many numbers. I've said enough in terms of numbers. I'm sure that some of your members in the audience will want to ask me questions. And if I know the answer, I'll give it to you. If I don't, I won't. But that's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Take your own question. I'm feeling you have no problem taking your own questions, and you're welcome to do it here, or if you'd like to take a seat for a while.
That's up to you. Whatever the protocol is.
Please.
Okay. All right. Yes. You've been taking lots of notes, so you should be the first.
I'm Harry Dunsey from the Associated Press. I'd like to try my luck with a question on currencies.
Thank you. And I'd like to try my luck with a question on currencies. During the meeting with French ambassadors during the summer, President Sarkozy said there had to be consultations on currencies. And according to the Financial Times last week, France has already begun this process with China. So I wondered, as you moved into the presidency of the G20, do you have specific ideas, or are you just going to see what is possible just to start the discussions? Thank you.
No, as I said, we don't have preset goals other than the ones that I've mentioned to you, which has to do with protection, diversification, and coordination. Those are the general principles that, in our view, should be addressed. But we don't have any preset outcome or preconceived or pre-designed ideas. I mean, it's daunting enough not to enter into the process with a map that is already drawn. So what we really want to do is consult in as broad a way as possible, including, as I said, you know, academics that have been working on it, institutions that have focused on the issue, economists, central bankers, former central bankers, and any flow of suggestions and information will be welcome in the process. We'll make it as interactive as we can. Yes, madam.
Thank you, Sarah Anderson from the Institute for Policy Studies. I think you are aware that you're considered somewhat of a hero among many international civil society groups for your support of financial transactions taxes within the G20. And since you didn't mention it, I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how you see that fitting into the agenda in 2011.
You're quite right. There is a whole chapter that I have not addressed at all, which has to do with That's actually part of my chapter four, but I'll come to that in a minute. But there's a whole chapter of financial regulations that I should have also mentioned. I did not, because I really tried to focus on these sort of new topics and new avenues that that we believe need to be explored. But clearly the whole chapter of financial regulations and all those, how would I put it, issues left out from the G20 momentum. And I would put in that category checking that we are actually delivering on the promises of Pittsburgh, of London, of Washington. And I would put probably Pittsburgh as the leading set of targets that had to be achieved. So making sure that everything we promised we'd do in terms of regulation, supervision, will have been delivered, will be on our list. Following up on the non-cooperative jurisdictions will also be on our list. And we will actually press for a report by the Compact Group during the year 2011 to make sure that the exchange of information addendum to non-double taxation treaties are actually ratified, implemented, that there is actually compliance with the commitments that have been made by the under the 500 agreements that have been signed in the last 18 months. That's also going to be on the list. But turning to your question on the, I was thinking to myself that we should rename this and we should call it a financial transaction contribution, because I know the word taxation doesn't sound right. And I know of one particular country where the word taxation is sort of resented. So a financial transaction contribution, I think, would be probably a nicer way to christen this initiative. But clearly, it's one where President Sarkozy, Chancellor Merkel, most recently, actually, the European Commission, through the Commissioner on Taxation, has actually also endorsed the project. And we hope many more will agree that it's one of the innovative financing ways to actually finance a combination of development on the one hand, climate change on the other. And we will have plenty of time to dispute as to how much should go to development, how much should go to climate change. But we cannot, on the one hand, say we need $100 billion, and by the way, $30 billion in 2011 under the fast-track agreement that was sort of agreed in Copenhagen, turn to our budgets and say, there's nothing left because we have to cut our deficits, we have to cut our public expenses, because that's the best way to reduce our deficit rather than raise new taxes. And yet, be consistent. So we need to find alternative sources of financing, what we call the innovative financing. And France is of the view, and President Sarkozy was very strong about it, that the financial transaction contribution would be a good avenue. We were comforted by the IMF study on the matter. The IMF did produce a study, did restrict a little bit the scope or the basis on which from which the contribution could be made, because they narrowed it to currency transactions, because it's easier to actually identify the clearing points. But yes, we believe very strongly that it's one of the innovative financing that need to be pursued. Extremely low rate, very large basis, ideal tax. Sorry, contribution. Yes, sir.
Anthony Rowley, Emerging Markets. Do you think perhaps too much is being expected of the G20, that it's being perhaps overburdened, given its relatively recent founding and, as I understand it, relative lack of secretariat facilities compared to the G7. And in that sense, realistically, what contribution can the G20 make to solving or producing some agreement on realignment of exchange rates when it's already so heavily burdened, it seems?
Well, I would contend that youth is not an obstacle to efficiency. Both you and I have grey hair, even white hair, actually, which should not lead us to assume that young institutions or young people can't actually deliver and produce and contribute to proposing ideas and improving the way in which we operate together. The issue of secretariat is a real one, and it's a real one particularly as a result of the rotating presidency and the fact that so far there has been 6 months presidencies, one after the other. France will be in presidency for 12 months in a row, which will give us a little bit more time to actually invest resources from, you know, our national budgets, essentially, to make it effective. Will that lead us to having a more solid secretariat and a few identified resources? Maybe so, but I agree with you. I don't agree on the youth issue, but I agree on the secretariat issue. We're clearly having to, you know, sort of work on a troika basis to pick up the work where it stands, and then allocating resources to support the system is an issue. I don't know what the ideal forum would be to actually discuss effectively currencies. I'm not sure that 20 is the absolute right number. But you see, I would draw a line between the institution where it is appropriate to reach a consensus and agree on the appropriate body and the appropriate body to actually deal with the matter. Yes, sir. It's you, yeah.
I'm Barry Wood, financial correspondent at Radio Hong Kong. Two questions, please, Ms. Lagarde. In terms of just the dynamics of the G20 process, isn't it difficult to have meaningful interaction among the leaders when they're there really just one day, and there are so many people who want to speak? And in that context, you've got, a meeting planned for the G8 and the G20 in Mexico in the next round. Is it a good idea to have the G8 and the G20 together? Will the G8 perhaps fade away and just keep G7 for finance? That's number one. Number two, if I could just shift a bit to the euro. There were obvious tensions in early May between Germany and France on Greece and the stabilization fund for Europe. I wonder if, first of all, if those tensions have been resolved, and if you feel now, 3 months after the fact, if things are going as you had hoped they would.
On your first question, I'm not in Mexico for the moment. I'm in France, and we're trying to allocate the right time, the right place for the appropriate meetings. And the scheduling of all that is it's not just protocol. It's not just etiquette. It's what will make more sense. What will be more efficient? In which order should we run meetings so that there is input from one group into the other, and it actually rolls to produce results. It's not so much a question of, you know, making sure that everybody has his territory. And because otherwise it will turn into a turf issue, and who is in, who is out, who is excluded, and all the rest of it. So it's more, which is why we're trying to work on this chapter principles and line of proposals, with a view to avoiding exactly the turf type of stuff that your question not allude to, but could lead me to. On your second point, there was a lot of tension in Europe and in the Eurozone. And I tell you something, I'm not about to forget the month of April and the weekend of the 9th and 10th of May, when overnight, we had to sort of put together this package of a maximum of 700 billion euros to set up this new financial instrument that was not considered in the European Treaty. It's actually extraordinary that this was feasible, doable, and that we could actually manage it. And I know that from the observer sitting on the fence and looking at this bunch of Europeans trying to agree on something, it looks funny and it looks slow. But it's quite incredible that you had 17 sovereign countries with their respective flags, national anthem, defense, foreign services and all the rest of it, actually agree that they're going to pool resources, set up this European financial special facility that will be used contrary to one of the treaty provisions. Because don't forget that under the Lisbon Treaty, in its latest version, we had a no bailout clause. So in other words, what we did was transgress from the treaty to put in place a facility that would actually rescue any member that would be in trouble. Now, Greece, we had already transgressed in a way, but we had not gone as far as we did with the European facility. Because with Greece, we had a contractual relationship where each member state lent to Greece to support it. With the European facility, we set up something which was totally different. It was an intergovernmental fund that was set up as a special entity governed under the laws of Luxembourg with a board and with the ability to actually collectively go together to support a country that would be in difficulty. So, of course, there were tensions. There were tensions because we were not happy to see what had happened with the statistics in one country or the other. We were not happy to see that deficit had to be updated every 3 weeks or so. But we managed to find, contrary to what the treaty would have allowed us to do, the strength and the political will to close ranks, be together, and put in place something which is extremely unusual, and which actually could be, you know, used as one of the format when we talk financial safety nets. That's at the European level, effectively what we put in place. But boy, what a weekend that was. Yes, sir.
You're right. Thank you. If I may ask the follow-up question.
Yeah, identify yourself.
Yeah, Hung Tran from the Institute of International Finance. The question is, would, in your mind, would the European Financial Stability Facility could eventually evolve into a European Monetary Fund?
That would be quite a logical evolution, wouldn't it? We'll see what the future has to offer. But I was particularly pleased to see that the facility was rated AAA by all three rating agencies. Yes, sir. I don't think it would be without consideration. Let's put it that way.
Madam Minister, how worried should we be, how worried are you about the persistent trade and large trade surpluses of Germany and China?
Well, it's two things that I would like to mention in response to your question. One is, in both cases, but more so probably in the case of China, we see that the pattern of growth is beginning to change. And when you look at the domestic consumption, the regional hubs that are being created on the ground in that part of the world, you clearly see a shift and an evolution that is happening, and that coincides with the recommendations that were made particularly by the IMF and that we all sort of collectively endorsed at our last meetings. That is happening. Second point I'd like to make is that the framework for growth, which was put together I think it was at the London meeting. That was decided at the London meeting. That was then framed and put together and reviewed in Toronto. We need to continue using it. We need to refine it. We need to make it more operative and more policy-based so that we effectively act together. What was very comforting at the time when all the action plans were aggregated is that there was a level of consistency, but we have not yet moved to the level of policy sharing and policy compliance, and I would hope that we can move in that direction. Okay, you and then you.
Probably have to be the last two for your
yes.
schedule.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Ooh, yeah.
I'm Mark Fried from Oxfam. Very pleased to hear you and very pleased to hear the focus that you're giving to the French presidency for the G20. It's actually very gratifying, the focus on poverty and the poorest communities that the G20 must address. Actually, you've touched on all of the issues that are dearest to Oxfam, the financial transaction tax, of course, and the food price volatility, tax havens, etc. My question is about the time frame. Korea talked about a multi-year action plan being developed for November. You talk about initiating discussions without a preconceived outcome. Do you foresee
Talking about initiating discussions without preconceived outcome on the International Monetary System, on the development plan. It's not without time frame. We will take the time frame that will have been put together by Korea, and we need to roll with it. And roll it out if it's a question of rolling it out.
Fabulous. So we will have concrete outcomes under the French presidency?
I should hope so.
Absolutely yeah. Wonderful. Thank you.
Trust Nicolas Sarkozy. Okay, last question. I forgot where it was.
How about you, Bruce?
Bruce Stokes, the National Journal and the German Marshall Fund. You mentioned policy compliance and coherence in the European context. It's my understanding that Koreans are also hopeful that countries will, I think they're using the term, inscribe various medium and long-term policy commitments in Seoul. There's always been difficulty going beyond transparency towards peer pressure and getting people actually to comply with what they've written down on a piece of paper. Given the European experience in trying to do that in a much more coherent unit, do you have any hope of getting this done in the G20 and any thoughts about how to kind of ratchet up the pressure on that issue?
I think your point is very well taken. Governments, countries, people only move if they are driven by their self-interest. It's very difficult to actually, achieve something higher and better than that, unless that collective endeavor actually brings results and benefits to the individual organization, the individual undertaking, the country's objectives. So we need to really associate the two together. Plus, and I would not downgrade that, quite to the contrary, I think there is public pressure and public opinion, particularly in the area of financial regulation, supervision, has been extremely helpful, and I would hope that it continues to express views and actually support the process of change that we would like to embark upon.
Thank you very much.
Madam Minister, thank you very much for both the set of remarks and your willingness to take such detailed and probing questions. We at Carnegie have been trying to provide a forum in a modest way for discussion and advancement of the G20 agenda, and today you've made an enormous contribution to that effort. And thank you very much.
Pleasure.